If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Godfrey Cheshire, who has a new book out, Life and Writings. There was a big collection of his writings, along with Matt Zoller Seitz's and Armand White's in the Press Gang a few years back. If you are a fan of vintage film criticism, it's a great collection. I recommend checking it out. But Godfrey, your new book is really interesting, kind of look at the breadth of your career, which is I feel like I'm repeating myself, but it's a true thing, and I want to say it again here. Sometimes people will come to me and they will say, "Sonny, how do I get your job? How do I do what you do?" And I tell them they can't. Like, this job kind of doesn't exist anymore. At least in the sort of professionalized way that I do it and that you did it for many years. Tell me about how you got involved, how you got started as a regular full-time critic.
Okay. I was very interested in film ever since I was young. And I tell the story that the thing I really think set me on the path was seeing John Ford's The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance at age 10 in Raleigh, where I grew up. And I saw that film. I really loved it. And at the end, I noticed the first credit said directed by John Ford. And that made me think, oh, this is the guy that's responsible for what I liked about this. So I'm going to start following him. I don't think any other of my friends that I went with had that reaction. I just became really interested in that. And I went on from there. And after I studied film when I was in college at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And then after that, I didn't do any writing during my college career. But after college, I wandered around Europe, as people did at that time. And there was a point where I was walking down a road in Crete one winter, and I decided I want to be a film critic when I go home. So I went home, and I had the great good fortune of meeting a guy who was about to start an alternative weekly. Those were kind of common in that era. And I signed on as his film critic and arts editor. It was very lucky. I had no I always joke, he had no money and I had no experience, so we were a perfect match. But the Alt Weekly, which is called Spectator Magazine and for Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill, got off the ground really fast. It was really popular. The guy who hired me, Bernie Reeves, who was the publisher, he had a really good idea. He said Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill are really a cultural unit, but the daily papers here treat them as they're separate islands, and they don't provide the people with the information they need about what's going on in the whole area. So he started with the idea, you just give people the information about the movie theaters and the dance performances and the cultural things that are going on around the area, and they'll pick it up for that reason. And that proved to be very true. Mm-hmm. But then on top of that, you could have really interesting cultural criticism. And I was very interested in trying to help the area build an art film exhibition scene, because up until that point, there had not been a successful art house in any of those cities. And when we started, there was one in Durham called the Carolina Theater. And I devoted a lot of time to writing about them when we got off the ground. And they said it made them a big success because people from Raleigh and Chapel Hill came to see the films there too. And so from there, I went on writing about the art films in the area. I started going to the New York Film Festival every year. I advised the theaters on what I thought would do well. I mean, I said, feel free to ignore my opinions, but I knew that what I wrote really helped them and really helped steer audiences toward them. And you have to remember that this was the era before the internet. So people, mm-hmm. and if you were in a third tier market or whatever, And an art film came that had premiered in New York 6 months before. How do people know anything about it? I mean, they can't, they've thrown out their New Yorker from 6 months ago, right? And where's the other information? And so as a local critic, and you tell people about this film, what's interesting about it, you know, you had a lot of power. And so I enjoyed using that power as best I could during that time. And I was very happy that the area grew quite a number of art theaters and that they succeeded. And so that's how I started out. And then in 1991, I moved to New York and got lucky, really lucky once again, in that I got hired by the Alt Weekly New York Press, who was looking for a film critic. And they read my stuff. They liked it. They said, come on down. That was right when I moved to New York. I was really lucky. I didn't move there because I was hired. I moved there with a backpack and a suitcase thinking I'm going to try to make it in New York. And I fortunately encountered this magazine, which was like Spectator, something that became very popular.
Yeah, it's funny because that is, again, one of these things where like, how do I do what you did? Well, you can't. That path is hard because there really aren't alt weeklies anymore, but there is still a profusion of film discourse, and there's no shortage of people writing about movies. But it feels both universal and atomized in a way that is that sounds like a contradiction. Like everybody's talking about the same movies, but they're all doing it almost to themselves, and there's no real. There's less of a community city by city, which is hard for these, you know, independent, you know, kind of more indie minded art house type cinemas. Right. Like how does word about movies get out now? Like that's the central question almost of this podcast.
Right. Well, I certainly agree with your memory of talking to people and have them ask, how can I do what you do? How can I have the career that you've had? It is impossible now to do that. Well, because the main thing was, you know, I had over 20 years of being a critic in North Carolina, then moving to New York and working for these alt weeklies that were very successful during that time. But then the internet exploded circa 2000 and really destroyed my career, basically, because these alt weeklies were supported by a lot of advertising. And in a lot of cases, it was X-rated advertising in the back of the paper. And as soon as the internet really exploded, all of that advertising moved to the internet. And it all went away from the alt weeklies, and it killed the alt weeklies, basically. But so I could earn a living doing this writing for over 20 years. But after the internet killed the alt weeklies, it was impossible to make a living writing of the kind of film criticism that I did. But I felt very lucky to be able to have that time, that space between the rise of the alt weeklies and then the death of the alt weeklies, because it gave rise to a kind of criticism that I felt like I had a lot of freedom. I could write about any movies I wanted to write about for both papers. I could write at any length. I could be as idiosyncratic and opinionated as I wanted to be. But, Sonny, the thing that I thought was most valuable that was being able to have like a consistent relationship with the readers, because I felt like in both places I had people that would read me every week, and I had a kind of relationship. I felt like, you know, they wrote in or whatever, but at least I felt like they were getting what I was saying. They may disagree with it all the time, but at least it was an ongoing thing. And then after that, I think that's what's missing now. There's no sort of go-to critic for a lot of people. It's like you're just looking for some information about, is this worth seeing or whatever? And there may be, you know, 20 critics that you glancingly look at, but there's not the weekly thing. You know, I had the great experience both in North Carolina and in New York of walking into coffee shops and seeing like half the people there reading the paper that I was writing for and often reading my columns and quoting to me things that I'd said when I had talked to people later. I mean, I really felt like this was a dialogue that I was having with a very informed, readership in both places. And that was very satisfying.
Yeah, I definitely get, kudos to the Bulwark audience, I will say, because I do get that sense here. You know, like we've got a nice comment sections and we've got, you know, regular readers, and it's nice to hear from folks who started as subscribers and have kind of become, correspondence, and it's been, I mean, frankly, this is how we got in touch. You reached out, which was
that's
really
right.
Nice. And like I said, I've been reading you for a long time. So I was like, oh, I know Godfrey Cheshire. Or I know of him. So this was fun. All right. So let's talk about working at the New York Press in the 1990s, because I feel like the 1990s is, I think in a lot of ways is kind of the last gasp of the American indie, you know, festival circuit. Like there's a lot of things happening from 1990 to 2000 that start to change after that as the industry gets bigger and the writing, the places where you can write kind of contract and audience taste is changing. What was it like to write in New York City in the 1990s, in the height of the, you know, kind of Sundance boom, the indie scene?
Well, you're right that it was a very distinct period in which a lot of interesting stuff was going on. I mean, I was very lucky to move when I did in 1991, because I came in at a time when there were things that were really starting to happen that were very interesting to write about. And, you know, one thing that was different, I say that when I was in North Carolina, I was very involved with the rock and roll scene there. And I had a lot of friends there, and there was a lot of dialogue around what people were doing and everything like that. But there was not really that around film in North Carolina. And I really didn't know any filmmakers. And the only directors that I ever talked to, they contacted me, were Robert Altman and David Lynch, who both contacted me to say thanks for review. David Lynch called me up and was like, "Is this Godfrey?" Yeah. It, I couldn't believe that it was David Lynch, but I, you know, of course, recognized his voice.
Yeah.
But he was in Chapel Hill because his daughter was going there, and he was there for a talk, and somebody gave him my review of Blue Velvet, and he liked it, so he called me up, and I came over and saw him and just went and had beer with him afterward. He was a really good guy, but that was such a rare experience. But when I got to New York, I started to know so many people in the film world, and I'm not talking just about filmmakers and directors and even actors and cinematographers, but also the people who worked at the theaters and the people who did the publicity and the people who worked at the Museum of Modern Art and film at Lincoln Center, et cetera, et cetera. So I felt like I was part of a real community in which there was a lot of information and dialogue going on all the time. But as you say, it was very interesting. The whole Sundance thing had given rise to this independent movement, which I thought I had various problems with it, but it was very vital at the time. And there were really interesting filmmakers coming up through it. And there were a number of those who were in New York, like Hal Hartley. I really liked his work, and he just came out of the box. And Richard Linklater, who was not from New York, but you know, that kind of director I thought was really vital and interesting and adding something to American cinema that hadn't been there before. So that was something I was very engaged with. And then there was a lot of international stuff that was happening too, especially regarding China and Iran. And I went to China, first of all, because there was a film being made called Farewell, My Concubine. And the producer who was making that was a woman, a very rich woman from Taiwan, who'd been an actress. And she wanted to bring some American critics over to know about this. She was aiming to win the Palme d'Or at Cannes with this film, and she did. It shared it with The Piano by Jane Campion. But so I went to China, but I'd already gotten interested in Chinese cinema in the mid-'80s and coming to the New York Film Festival. And I tried to start learning as much as I could about Chinese culture and history and everything, so I would be more prepared. But once I got there, it really helped to meet people and to see things in, you know, in that context and learn more about it. So I wrote a lot about that, and I went to Taiwan, I went to Hong Kong. That was something that really got me started. And then those films that were coming out of there were really amazing until the Chinese government cracked down in 1995. The films that were coming out of mainland China changed a bit at that time. But after that, I had written that article about Farewell, My Concubine, the making of, for Film Comment, and they liked it. And so when there was a festival of Iranian films, the first festival of post-revolutionary Iranian films, came to Lincoln Center in late 1992, they asked me to go and take a look and see if it was worth an article. I had no idea, not the slightest idea, that anything was going on in Iran. So I went with no expectations, and I was really blown away by the films I saw and the filmmakers that were represented there. So I started writing about them. I started following Iranian cinema, writing about it, you know, as often as I could, and then meeting different Iranian directors, and then covering the Cannes Film Festival and meeting Iranian directors there and seeing films there. You know, during the 90s, I also, starting in 1995, I wrote for Variety, and that took me a lot of places around, you know, the globe, covering festivals and such. So that was another thing that happened that I hadn't had before in North Carolina. But I thought all of this was very, very interesting, and I was very excited about the opportunities I had to write about these different subjects.
Can you talk a little bit more about Iranian cinema? Because I feel like we are almost every year now, there is a movie out of Iran that is often considered to be, you know, front runner for best foreign language feature, or just is really interesting. I've written about Jafar Panahi, and there's, you know, but I'm by no means an expert in it. And I reading your remembrances of it in the interviews that you do with Nicholas Elliott in this book, in addition to just reading some of your writings from the time, it reads, and I think you say as much, that you had a real almost religious kind of spiritual connection to these films. What was it about Iranian cinema at the time that so changed you?
Well, to start off with, that festival of films that I saw in 1992, I was really impressed, but with the sense of a whole cinema that I'd never even heard of, that had a lot of dimensions to it. It had even commercial films and war films that were basically propaganda films that were really interesting cinema. But above that, it had a real auteur cinema with directors like Abbas Kiarostami, Darius Mirjoui, Bahram Bezai, Mohsen Makhmavov, Amir Nadri, and others who I just thought these are full-fledged artists who have real, you know, careers behind them, and I've never heard of them. And the more I encountered their work, the more impressed I was with it. But the more I learned about Iran and studied all of this, and I started going to Iran in 1997 to cover their film festival. The culture people there started inviting me because of what I'd been writing. And the more I really looked into it, the more I realized that all of this came from a very deep culture. We don't really study Persian culture much in the West, if you go to college or whatever. But there's a, you know, 2,500-year-old culture there with very deep roots of art and cinema and philosophy, some of it connecting to religion and such. But I, you know, it came out of that. I mean, the U.S. is at a war with Iran right now, that we're finding out that, wait, this isn't something you can just blow away in an afternoon of bombing. It's a culture that's been there for thousands of years, and they'll be there. But they have very deep cultural roots, and I was very taken with a lot of the individual films I saw. You know, Kiarostami was the one that actually impressed me the most on first encounter in terms of the films I saw. The film Close Up was the one that really blew me away. It's a film about a man that's on trial for impersonating another filmmaker, the director Mohsen Makhmavov. And I was just sort of really taken with the sort of meta cinematic aspects of this. Films about filmmakers and filmmaking. That was something I wasn't expecting to see from, you know, a place like Iran. And they were very sophisticated films. And so I kept following them. I kept writing about them. But I also went into the kind of spiritual and mystical aspects of it. And it really changed me. I could talk for hours about how that happened and what the results were. But I will just say that I did a lot of deep reading and a lot of thinking and meditating about many of the things that I encountered there. So there was that dimension of the whole experience for me, a kind of a spiritual dimension that came on top of the cinematic experience. But I have been really impressed that the Iranian cinema has continued on to be so vital. You know, it's funny, when I first started going to Iran and we're talking to cinephiles and critics, they said, wow, we've had this boom. The boom really started, you know, Iran had a really interesting decade before the 1979 Iranian Revolution that was called the Iranian New Wave, mm-hmm. of a bunch of directors who came out and made really interesting films. They hardly got seen outside of Iran, but they were really the basis of which the cinema revived after the revolution. After the revolution, the government was persuaded to try to revive the cinema for various reasons, and they did. And some of the directors that started out were ones that had been there before the revolution that were welcomed back in, but others were ones that came out of the revolution and were a new generation of filmmakers. But yeah, once it got going, it was really amazing. But when people said, how much do you, in the 90s, they said to me, how long do you think this will last? I was thinking, well, the French New Wave lasted about 12 years, Italian neorealism about 7 years, maybe, you know, 10, 12, 15 years. But it's just gone on. And there's been a new generation and a new, you know, new lifeblood coming into the cinema. I mean, you know, Iranian cinema won two Oscars, both by the director Asghar Farhadi in the 2000s. And that was something I would never have foreseen in the 1990s when I was doing this. And that was a director who came, you know, kind of the third generation after the post-revolutionary cinema got revived. And so it's never started to tail off. And, you know, they're going through an obvious crisis right now due to this war, but I have no doubt that they're going to bounce back in a really interesting way. And there's a film in the, you know, upcoming New York Film Festival by Mani Hagigi, who is a director I've known since before he started making films 20 years ago. And he's a really interesting artist. I'm glad he's starting to get attention because there have been things that have happened in recent years that, because I think the market in the U.S. for foreign language films has, you know, declined, some of these really interesting films haven't gotten distribution in the United States. But I think, you know, they're going to go on and on, you know, getting attention. And I think more and more of the newer films will start getting distribution just because of how good and interesting they are.
Yeah, one of the reasons, frankly, that I started paying a little more attention to Iranian cinema was, I to be totally blunt, the bravery of the filmmakers, the you know, reading about Mahmoud Rasoulof getting essentially can't go back to the country. He is living in exile right now, the director of Seed of the Sacred Fig. And then, of course, Jafar Panahi. Is there something to be said for the tension between the government and the repression of the religious authorities and what the filmmakers are making? I mean, I'm curious what your read of the political situation over there is and how that informs the filmmaking.
Yeah, well, it's a complicated situation and it changes, you know, from regime to regime. I mean, if the hardliners come in, they are really trying hard to suppress the filmmakers and to control them basically and to keep, you know, anti-regime sentiment from coming out. But the filmmakers have always been very resourceful about how they deal with this stuff. And in some ways, I think it may be, you know, incorrect to say this, but I think the repression kind of inspires them to get more creative and to want to get around these restrictions. It's really inspiring to see, to go there and see the filmmakers and talk to them and see all the kind of difficulties they have. And yet they keep on keeping on. Jafar Panahi is a great example of that. You know, he was in New York last fall, and he was talking about the fact that he had not seen his films with an audience outside of Iran or an audience anywhere, I think, in 17 years. You know, they had been repressing him, but he'd gone on making the films, sending them to international festivals. But, I mean, filmmakers in this country have no idea of the kind of difficulties that are imposed on Iranian filmmakers. And I think that they're just really heroic in a lot of cases to be able to deal with these restrictions and to go on making films no matter what. You know, my friend Mani Hagi, who I just mentioned, I saw him in Iran a couple of years ago, and I asked him about the stuff about the censorship, and he was very funny. He just talked about, you know, they've got the government censors. They look at your new film, you go in, they say, you got to cut out a half an hour of this. And he said, I just start arguing and I argue and I argue for days and days. And at the end of like several days, they're exhausted and they say, okay, cut out 30 seconds and just get the hell out of here. And that's how he deals with it.
Yeah. It is a region and a area of filmmaking that I wish I had more time, frankly, just more, always need more time. There's never enough. All right. Coming back to America, I want to talk a little bit. So again, the book here is Cheshire and Film, and it's there's a cross section of old reviews and old interviews. There's a really good interview that you have with David Lynch in this, which is fascinating because the interview itself is he is taciturn. I think is the best way to describe it. But as you kind of frame in the essay that accompanies it, before that, it's because he never was very fond of intellectualizing what he was doing, which is interesting and does kind of bring me to a question about what you feel the role of the critic is as speaker for the filmmaker, as you know, the kind of interpreter of the filmmaker who is unable to speak for himself beyond what's on the screen, or unwilling to speak for himself, or you know, what do you think your role is as an interpreter of film for both filmmakers and for readers?
Well, I think that's a good question, and I think the word interpreter is very appropriate because I think the filmmaker really doesn't need to explain what he's up to or what he's done beyond just putting it on screen. I mean, I think that that's really what filmmakers are, you know, are trying to do, and that they shouldn't be expected to do anything beyond that. You know, I made one film, a documentary called Moving Midway, that was about my family's plantation in the South. And the one thing I came out of that thinking was that I don't think filmmakers really know what they have done until it's on the screen in front of a bunch of people. I didn't really have any idea what kind of reaction my film would get. I had some hopes, but I didn't really know. And I think that's true with most filmmakers. But once the film is done and is out there in public, I think readers often look to critics to say, to begin the discussion, like I say, begin the discussion, not to, you know, nail down any final definitions or opinions, but to say, this is what I think this guy is trying to do and why you should look at it and what, you know, what you should consider in judging it. And to me, it's always been kind of a conversation, even though very seldom am I hearing back from readers saying, oh, I think you missed this or you were perfectly right about this. I think it is a way of starting a discussion that helps readers try to connect with the work. Because to me, a lot of the best films are films that are not really easy to interpret or understand right off the bat. You got to spend some time. You got to think about it, maybe talk to people, maybe read some things. But I think the critic can help those discussions and those understandings get off the ground.
A key here is differing perspectives, bringing a different, you know, having people talking about a film coming at it from a different perspective. And one of the things that you write about a couple times in your book is you're from North Carolina. You grew up in North Carolina. You moved to New York City. And one of the things that you kind of mention coming up again and again is Hollywood and filmmaking, kind of in general, and a sort of discomfort with the South, a sort of a caricature of the South that is, you know, that often kind of comes up. Can you talk about that just a little bit and what you see as, you know, some of the weaknesses in film and discussion about the films when it comes to how people react to either films set in the South or dealing with Southern subject matter? What do you see as some of the issues here?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because, you know, growing up in the South, I became very aware of being a Southerner. And I think that people from outside the South, they don't have that experience, I don't think. You know, I feel like in some ways the South is a separate culture and there are a lot of complicated issues surrounding it. And as far as, you know, growing up young, as I did during the civil rights era, there were a lot of things that made you very conflicted about a Southern identity and what it meant to be Southern and what the region's culture was and what it was worth and what was wrong with it and what was right with it. And so I thought a lot about this before I started writing as a critic. And I will say that there were two people that were very influential on my thinking, one a critic and one a filmmaker. The critic was Jonathan Rosenbaum, who, you know, I started reading when I was in college, and he was writing for a variety of magazines, and a lot of it from Europe and a lot of it about French cinema, very sophisticated. analysis of this, but when he had his first book, Moving Places, he wrote a lot about growing up in Alabama and his view, you know, on the world and on cinema from the point of view of a Southerner. And I really liked that. And I thought that's a model of what I would do if I were to start writing about film and to start writing about, you know, the way that a lot of these films are completely off in dealing with the South. And then the filmmaker who came along that really, really electrified me in a way was Ross McElwee with his first film, Sherman's March, with his first feature that came out. I had met Ross. I'd seen some of his work earlier. He's from North Carolina like me, and I'd seen some of his work and met him before Sherman's March. But that was really a very important film, I think, not just for me, but for a lot of people in the country, because he dealt with the South and a lot of its complexity in a very sophisticated but very engaging and humorous way. And the humor, I think, was very important to presenting the South in a way that was complex and that I thought was really a model of how to get the South right without being pretentious about it or whatever, but being very entertaining and insightful at the same time. And, you know, and one piece in my book is about the band REM, who are from Athens, Georgia, and I became mm-hmm. good friends with them and went on tour with them. And I remember there being, you know, a lot of conversations about Southern identity. They were from Athens, Georgia. And it was something that was still an unsettled question, but it was something that everybody was kind of interested in dealing with. And I remember one time very early in their career, they came back from one of their first sort of national tours, and there was a party for them. And I saw Michael Stipe there, and he said, you know, when we crossed the Mason-Dixon line coming home, everyone burst into tears. And I thought that was funny. It was kind of like a Michael-esque exaggeration, but it was just saying something about the way that people at that time felt about the South and felt like they needed to think about it and deal with it in some way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's just interesting. And I think one of the facets of criticism that does not quite get enough attention from the critics themselves is thinking about where they're coming from and, you know, what experiences they may have had that inform how they write. I don't want to get into a whole thing there. That's a whole nother episode. you mentioned your documentary. Can we talk about that a little bit? Because I've not seen it, full disclosure. I am curious what your experiences as a film critic and how those kind of informed what you wanted to do when you were shooting it and maybe more to the point, editing it, putting the story together.
Right. Well, you know, Sonny, I'm going to send you a link to the film so that you can
see
it.
Please.
But you'll see that it is a film about the South from the point of view of a Southerner, but also of a film critic. And what I do is the way that this came about was that my family has had this plantation in North Carolina since well before the Civil War. And I grew up going out there. It was a very romantic place to me. It was like it hadn't changed. It didn't seem like it had changed since the Civil War. And then in 2002, my cousin, who now owns it, and his wife told me that they were thinking about moving all the buildings because they were being encroached upon by the urban sprawl of Raleigh. And it was not as beautiful and great as it was in earlier years. So I thought, well, this is a chance to make a film about this place that I've always thought about making a film about, but it's like now or never because they're going to change it completely. And I also thought, this is bound to be an interesting story, moving all these buildings somewhere else. It's going to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and even if the whole thing falls apart, it's going to be a story. So I thought that gives me a thing to work with. But also, I wanted to talk about the mythology of the Southern Plantation because I've never seen anybody write about this, but the Southern Plantation has been at the center of a lot of key American artworks, audiovisual artworks from The Birth of a Nation, in which it appears in a very small way, but it's still an important way, up through a bunch of films, including Gone with the Wind, and then after that, down to Roots on television. You know, Gone with the Wind at one point Birth of a Nation, Gone with the Wind, and Roots were all thought of as like the most successful, works in their genre or whatever mm-hmm. at the time. They were hugely successful. So I've in my film I interweave some considerations of these depictions of the plantation and what they meant. I mean, the meaning of the plantation changed throughout the history of the cinema and of American art. So I thought that was an interesting subject. So I interweave these things with the story of the moving of the plantation, which was surrounded by a lot of debate within the family. Should you do this? Would it work? Whatever. And ultimately, the plantation was moved. I just came from it. I went out there this morning. I haven't been there in a few years, but I came back here and I went out to it. So it survived the move, thankfully. And so it's still there as a family place to gather. And during the making of the film, I discovered that I have 100 African-American cousins I didn't know anything about, thanks to the plantation. And I started to meet them, and that became a whole aspect of the story. Which was in a way, I mean, it reflects an unfortunate part of history, right? An unfortunate dimension of history, but it was kind of a fortunate way to deal with that and to meet real people rather than just talk about it, slavery in the abstract.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I want to talk about, there are two, if I recommend this book to people to just read one or two things in it, it is this kind of diptych of essays, the Death of Film and the Decay of Cinema. And I think you know, these were written in at the end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s. So we're at a very important and key point that I think very few people saw was coming at the time. And these read incredibly prescient in hindsight. But let's talk. All right. So the Death of Film is very specifically about the actual technical medium of film, of shooting celluloid through a camera with light capturing images, and what the decline of that and the shift to digital in theaters would do, which was, again, this was a big thing at the time, right? In 2002, I believe, you know, George Lucas is like, you're not going to be able to see the next Star Wars movie if you don't have the digital projectors. And that wasn't quite the case. It wound up being pushed off a few years. It wouldn't be until really the 3D boom of the Avatar years that change fully kind of went into effect. But like, this was all starting to happen. And it has changed things. I'm curious, looking back on those essays now, do you think it has been as disastrous as you thought, or not as bad?
Well, you know, I wrote those essays because I wrote them both in the summer of 1999. And it was spurred by the fact that I went and saw the first digital films projected in a movie theater, just regular projection. And I thought, wow, this is really going to change things. So I started thinking about that, and that's what started me on writing the essays. And the premise was, you know, for all of us, movies, cinema, since the beginning, since 1895, has been one technological thing. It's been, as you said, running celluloid through a camera and then having film that you project onto a screen, and you edit it, of course. And of course, a lot of things were added during the course of the history of sound and color and all that. But the technology has been basically the same for 105 years, and it's all about to change completely. They're going to get rid of film, one of the things is I started talking to Roger Ebert at the Cannes Film Festival that year, and he was saying, you know, wait a second, this technological change is going to come, but nobody has said, stop, look, wait, let's talk about this. Let's look at the possible ramifications. And I thought he was right. And so that was one of the other things that inspired it. But I started thinking about what all of this would mean, what technologically the changes would mean. And that's really what the Death of Film part of it is about. But I didn't really foresee disaster at all. I just felt like it was going to mean a lot of changes, some of which might be fairly negative in terms of the things that we valued and loved about cinema up until that point, right? That they might be lost. And yet at the other side of it, looking back in retrospect, I really see a lot of benefits that digital has brought. I mean, when I looked at making a list of the best films of the last 20 years, some of the ones that I really liked the most, including, like, for example, Laura Poitras's Citizen Four. Like, that was my best film of that decade. That could not have been done without digital. Russian Ark by Sokurov, that couldn't have been done without digital. And quite a number of other things that I just really liked that were completely owed to the existence of the digital technology. So it was not a disaster, and I was happy to discover that the results were not as negative as I'd thought they could be. I mean, there were negative results. There were things that were lost, but there were also new possibilities that were opened up that still go on, you know, changing and offering new opportunities.
Well, it definitely, you know, reading these essays, and they're largely focused on the distribution and exhibition side of things. But it, well, I think, indisputably, I'm sorry. Yes, the first of them. But I think indisputably, right, that digital filmmaking using digital cameras has made film and filmmaking more accessible. Certainly, you do not have to spend $100,000 on equipment anymore. You can make something with you know, credit cards lack of a better word, which I, you know, that again, there are pluses and minuses to any change, but it does I don't like change is bad, but you know, this change seems to have largely worked. Let's talk a little bit about the decay of cinema, though, because I do, so this is the second of these essays, which is in part about the way film will come to resemble television a little more. I just want to read one quick passage here from your book. Reading from the book, television, 1,000 times more powerful and pervasive, was destined to swallow its older sibling whole, and with it a vast range of cultural understandings and values. In McLuhan-esque terms, if you will, cinema marks the last stand of the culture of literacy before its final submission in TV's post-literate what's it? End quote. And I'm kind of curious how you feel about that now, because if anything, it feels like TV has become more film-like in certain ways, in terms of the sophistication of stories and the star power and all of that. And at the same time, I can't help but think that you are also right that the television style serialization of, for instance, the Marvel Cinematic Universe or the whole kind of shared universe phenomenon has had real negative consequences for filmmaking as an art form.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. I mean, you're right in that, and this was one of the things I think I predicted, was that right after this change was made, a lot of television was imitating filmmaking techniques and values and such. You know, the era of, what did they call it, peak television or whatever, Mad Men and Breaking Bad and things like that. They were really like big cinema. And it was something that I'd kind of anticipated and looked forward to, was that, you know, a filmmaker, I remember Francis Coppola talking about this in the 90s, saying that once we can, you know, expand the medium and we can have things that are like, you know, like TV soap operas that are really artistic and go on for a long time and have like 100-hour lengths rather than just being confined to 2 hours. So there was some artistic possibility that opened up there. But I think that went away kind of fast. I mean, the more recently, things that have been up there, they have some superficial sophistication that makes you think of films past, but they don't have kind of the deep artistic vision that the best films have. And I think of deep artistic vision as being associated with auteurs, with real brilliant thinkers who are working in film, like David Lynch or Francis Coppola or some of these others that have turned out the masterpieces of recent decades. You find that less and less, I think. You find sort of talented craftspeople doing it. But, you know, in television, it's really the producer, the showrunner, who's controlling everything. And those people are, you know, they're not in the job of having a vision. They're in the job of making a product that goes out to a lot of people. and succeeds on its terms. And so I feel like a lot of the things that are that I think, you know, and that we've celebrated and loved in great cinema of the 20th century, especially the second half of the 20th century, has been bled out of what has come after that.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. I mean, you definitely had the sort of auteur showrunner with your David Chases, yeah. Vince Gilligan, I think, he's making Pluribus on Apple right now, and I don't know what Matt Weiner with Mad Men, but it definitely feels like that era is kind of over now.
That's right. And, you know, I've talked to people in the business and filmmakers and such, and they do say that era is over. That was great. If you aspire now to make a Mad Men or something like that, the people who produce these things are not interested in that. They're not interested. So, and, you know, so that's where we are now. And I don't know that it's necessarily in a very good place, although there is a lot of stuff to see. I don't know that there's a lot of stuff that's really great.
Yeah. Well, it just, again, in kind of McLuhan-esque terms, a show like Mad Men can succeed on AMC with only 1 to 2 million people watching it because the business of AMC was, you know, predicated on getting the affiliate fees. It wasn't based on ratings and all that. Sure. It was, you know, and now with streaming, you need massive audiences. Everybody wants, you know, 100 million subscribers, and that, you know, that doesn't really work. All right, let me. You have some events coming up. I want to make sure we plug those. You're going to be in New York City coming up. Tell people where you're going to be and where they can see you.
Okay. Well, let me first of all plug the book again. The book is called Cheshire on Film, Life and Writings, and it is, as you've noted, partly an interview with me about my whole career, and partly a collection of my essays and writings over 40 years. And that just went on sale yesterday, and it's available. And if you just Google Cheshire on Film, I'm sure you can find a way to get it.
I'll make sure there's a link in the show notes as well. People can click on that and read it. It also you didn't mention this. There's a nice foreword by Alex Winter in the book, which is nice.
Alex Winter, the star of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, but also a great filmmaker who's made a lot of really good documentaries and dramatic films and such. He and I became really good friends in the 90s and have continued. And it's been great being friends with somebody who has his perspective on the industry. I mean, in a lot of ways, he's a very independent spirit, but he's been involved with Hollywood. He knows sort of the whole dimension. And so he lived in New York after we got to be friends. And so we saw each other a lot. And then he moved to California, where he's been for a long time. And so we don't see each other as much, but we are in constant conversation about things. So we're going to have this event in New York on September 21st at the IFC Center. And it's going to be a conversation between me and him about these various issues and about my career. And it's going to be a book signing too. As you said, he wrote the foreword to the book. So I'm really looking forward to that. I think it's going to be fun. We're going to show some clips from various things too and talk about our work and talk to the audience about our work. Before that, just in a couple of days in Raleigh, on Wednesday, September 9th, there's going to be an event at the Raleigh, at the Rialto Theater, which in fact is the theater where I saw The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance at age 10. And set me on the path that I've been on ever since. But we're going to do that, and I'm going to have discussions with two people that are, you know, different parts of my life, one about the Raleigh Spectator era and another about the national and international work I did. And I think that'll be fun, too. And we'll sell and sign books in both places.
Yeah. And again, like I said, I'll have a link in the show notes here. You can click on that and pick up the book. And again, I really it's a hard sell getting people to read criticism at the best of times, but I'm telling you, it's if you care about the history of film, and want a unique individual perspective on the last 20 or 30 years or so of film and the film business, I hope you check it out, because it's a fascinating. It's a fascinating book. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything I forgot to ask. What do you think folks know that we did not discuss here today?
Sonny, I can't hardly think of anything. I'm going to try to, but I think you've done a great job of sort of covering the waterfront here. Really, you've asked about many of the things that I've, you know, been most concerned with through my life as a critic. And, you know, it's been really, I feel very fortunate to have come along at the time that I did and to have had a lot of this art to really engage with and to try to connect people with the art, because that's really the essence of what I've been trying to do.
I think that's a striking and nice way to put it in terms of what critics do, is connecting people to the art. And it is something I think about all the time. What can I show people? What can I point people to that they will want to watch and hopefully get something out of? So,
right.
It's very nice. Godfrey, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
I really enjoyed it, Sonny, and good luck to you with this show, because it's really a good one. Good one.
Thank you.
Good one.
Thank you.
All right.
My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.
Hey, let's talk about something a lot of us deal with: thinning hair or hair loss. If that sounds familiar, CAPS has solutions. Their hair restoration treatments are personalized, designed to strengthen your existing hair, encourage regrowth, and improve scalp health. The providers at CAPS guide you every step of the way with advanced treatments for noticeable, long-lasting results. And when you book your first hair restoration appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.